Now it's Mike Slater.
Good morning, Cider Crusaders. America's the greatest country in the world. San Diego's America's finest city. Thanks for being here. Happy Thursday. Water, name of the game again today. We spent the last hour talking about some history, the money, following the money, the ultimate goal to rewild the land. We talked a couple days ago about the president's top science advisor who says we need to de-develop the United States, all part of the same mentality. Kick humans off of land and bring nature back to its natural state. So that's what's pushing this whole thing. Assuming that we actually wanted to use nature for human benefit while still being good stewards of the environment, which is a biblical and conservative principle, of course. But how can we actually get more of, water moving forward? I want to talk with Terry Anderson, who's from PERC. PERC is fantastic there, the Property and Environmental Research Center. Terry, tell me if this is a good one-sentence analysis. Environmentalists who come up with environmental solutions using free market methods.
That describes PERC.
Perfect. And I love that approach because free market's the only effective way of helping the environment.
Those of us who are at PERC wouldn't live in Montana and endure winters if we weren't environmentalists, if you will. We care about where we live, but we think markets can take care of the environment and provide the right incentives way better than government.
Why do people have the knee-jerk reaction of environment must be controlled by government? The government has to be the people in charge of it.
I think part of the reason is that there are cases where what would appear to be environmental damage or destruction comes about because we don't have clear ownership of the resources, say water. If I'm trying to get rid of my gunk and I have a stream flowing by and it isn't clear who has the right to use the stream, I dump my gunk in the cheapest place. And those examples from earlier in the 20th century and even up to mid-century, I think are some of the things that led to the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. And there may have been some good reason to pass legislation to say we need to have at least healthy standards for air and water. But we've gone, you know, way beyond that. The kinds of things that the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, saving the bald eagle, for example, we're trying to do. Now we're, you know, saving some, I heard last night on the radio, some spotted butterfly in California is stopping the construction of solar panels.
Yeah. So it's imploding on itself. The environmentalist movement is, right? But you made such a good point. So the free market has been demonized for something that happened, right? Dumping toxic chemicals into a river, demonized for something that happened because there was no free market and property rights on that river.
Yeah. Exactly, and we document my most recent book with Don Leal and several young co-authors on chapters documents how markets can clean up water, how markets can even clean up air, and certainly can better manage the land. Just take a look at how poorly the federal government manages its land. A new study from PERC just shows that federal government loses money over and over on its lands, from timber, grazing, mining, everything, and then doesn't manage them well. They're in poor shape. Behind my house is timber ready to go up in flames, and the trees have been marked for 10 years to be cut, but lawsuits halting the actual logging have left them standing. And so those forests aren't good wildlife habitat. They're not good water supply sources. And this is just typical of government management of land.
And if they don't thin the forest, I think this was last year, there was one wildfire emits more global warming gases than all the industries in the world. It's some ridiculous fact like that these wildfires are bad for the environment.
Well, you know, the wildfires are, but smaller fires that occurred, that would occur if we manage the timber better would be healthy for the environment. It would clean up some of the areas that are too densely forested and can't be logged. But right now, we don't log anything. There are virtually no trees that come off the federal lands today. And the result is these are old growth forests, but old growth forests aren't places that most creatures like to live. And old growth is just another one of these environmental terms that gets thrown out as part of the religious altar that environmentalists serve at.
Yep, absolutely. Well, let's talk about water now. So, give us some solutions here, Terry. We've talked a lot about the issues, the problems, and how we got here, but let's talk solutions.
Well, I'm here at the Hoover Institution, so I'm in the midst of middle of California, where the water, where the drought handed to us by nature is certainly real. I saw a map of the Sierras recently comparing the snowpack today versus a normal year, and you know, the Sierras are all white in a normal year, and there's this little band of white at the very summits today. So the drought is real. The scarcity is real, but the problems we face are made up mostly because of policies that have created this. Let me just start with keeping water cheaper than dirt is the way I like to think of it. Most cities in California deliver water at very low prices. They don't cover their infrastructure costs. They don't cover the storage costs, the delivery costs. And so the consumer isn't paying the full price. And then adding to that is the fact that this water might be worth more in other uses. And these kinds of making water cheap and delivering it at low prices. I should add that some cities don't even meter yet, don't meter their water at the home. So if I go to the gas pump and they say, hey, pay $10 and take as much gas as you want, guess what I'll do? I'll take plenty. Yeah. So we have that problem. And then in addition to that, we have the fact that water can't trade. In California, less than 5% of all the annual water used goes through a water market. 5%? Imagine that if we traded bicycles and only 5% of all the bicycles traded in California were in the market and the rest of them couldn't be traded.
Interesting. All right, can I cut you off on both? No, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I just want to add then that I was thinking today as I was riding my bicycle from my condo to the office, and Stanford's filled with bicycles. What if tomorrow we woke up and half the bicycles were gone? That Martians invade and take them. And we didn't have a market for bicycles. We wouldn't know what to do. The people who wanted bikes would say, well, where do I go to get it? What am I going to do? I can't survive. And I think thinking of that in the context of water is just what we have. People don't trade water, and so when you get the kind of scarcity that nature has dealt California, it's impossible to think of ways to deal with it.
Yeah, so the people with extra bicycles can't sell them. They're not allowed to sell them to the people who with no bicycles.
Yeah. I mean, I ride my bike. I'd be willing to sell it or rent it and walk. But if there's no market and people didn't know how to trade bikes, what would they do?
Well, we had someone call in yesterday. We brought that point up because we talked to one of your colleagues yesterday. And someone called in after the show and said, Slater, it's not the same. I use the example of TVs instead of bicycles. But he said it's not like selling TVs because water is a common resource and it has to be used for the common good. And you can't just... You shouldn't be allowed to sell it. And I said, well, you know what? And Roger Hedgecock, our former host, was on, and he said, what about your well water? You should own that. And he said, well, you have these large basins that go underneath lots of people's property. So how can you even divvy that up? So is there something inherently different about water than a bicycle?
I don't think there is at all, other than, you know, water flows across time, it flows across space, and bicycles are stationary, they're well defined, but no more or less well defined than a bucket of water would be or a bottle of water you buy at the local market. So I don't see a difference, but there is this. I once debated Maud Barlow, a person from Canada who now is at the United Nations, and she makes the claim that water is something that people have a human right to. Yeah. And when that debate, I said, well, all right, let me grant you that as a society, we have a responsibility to deliver enough water for humans to live. Well, suppose that's 50 gallons a day, which is more than enough. I mean, if you go camping in a place where there isn't water and you have to carry it from the lake for 200 yards,
sure.
you don't use very much.
Yeah.
So, but we could get by. So suppose we said 50 gallons. Well, if you look at average household consumption in the United States, it's way above that. So how much do we have a human right to? So when I hear the arguments that you just put forward, I say, okay, let me grant you, we'll just as a society agree that we have to supply some water for free. But after that, let's increase the price, and let's increase it at an increasing rate. And that would mean that people would start being very careful on how much they use.
Now, I can tell you, there's people listening now who are thinking, hold on here, Terry. We live in California. Water is crazy expensive. Look at my water bill. And you're saying raise the price. How do you juxtapose that?
Well, if people call in, my first question would be, tell me what your water bill is. Most people wouldn't have a clue. I live in a Stanford condominium complex. I don't pay for my water. I have no clue what my water bill is. But my guess is that anybody who knows what it is, if they compare it to their gasoline bill or their electric bill or their food bill or their going out to movie bills, they will have to admit water is still cheaper than dirt.
Now, my goal is to have more resources provided for us, not necessarily less. And if you raise the price, then people are going to use less, which has its merit. But aren't there ways to provide more?
Of course there are. Your previous hour dealt with some of this. But, you know, there are proposals to raise Shasta Dam by 18 feet. And if they did so, it would provide huge amounts of water. I think I have the number here. It would provide, if they raise the level of Shasta Dam. Now, mind you, this is a dam that's already there. So, yes, it'll inundate some more land. But if they raise it in a typical year, it would increase, produce enough water for 550,000 people a year. But the proposals aren't to, as you talked about, aren't to raise dams. They're to take them out.
Wait, so say that fact again. So if we raise it 18 feet, and it's already 600 feet high. So if you raise it
the biggest in California.
Okay, so 18 feet higher, it would be enough water for 500,000 people?
Exactly.
Or 500,000 families. 500,000 families or people?
People.
Okay, 500,000 people. That's 40% of the city of San Diego.
Yeah. Is that enough? Well, there are lots of ways. I mean, even desal at some point, if water gets costly enough, might be a profitable way to produce water. But if I take on desal, then I come back and have to say, desal, we're still talking at $3,000 for 325,000 gallons. That's an acre foot. So $3,000, well, you can buy, and it's happening today, you can buy water from farmers in the Central Valley for $700. In fact, Municipal Water District of Southern California is negotiating and deals with farmers in the Central Valley for just that. And the farmers are saying, I'm not going to grow tomatoes and earn maybe $150 if I can sell that water for $700.
Interesting. Okay, can you stick around for one more segment?
One point I want to make sure I emphasize, though, if I come back to Shasta Dam, because I think this is important. The proposals to raise Shasta Dam, why don't we just do it? But the proposals to raise Shasta Dam, would happen with the federal taxpayer paying 60% and California paying the 40%. Oh, wait a minute. This isn't getting the incentives right.
Yeah.
Those people living in New York are going to pay for California's water. There's no value to New York of raising Shasta Dam. And so I always say if water runs uphill to money, some people say it gushes uphill to politics.
Yeah.
And if you're a California politician and you say, well, I can soak the rest of the country for $60 on $100, this is a good deal.
Interesting. All right, can you stick around for one more segment, Terry?
You bet.
Perfect. It's Terry Anderson from PERC, PERC.org. 1-800-760-KFMB if you have a question for Terry here. Mike Slater Show. Spread the word. Slater Crusaders talking with Terry Anderson from PERC, Property and Environment Research Center. Fantastic group. Check them out. Support them any way you can. Good people. Environmentalists with free market solutions. Terry, let's talk. Thanks for sticking around. Let's talk about what some other cities have done around the world and country. I'm checking here on your website about the Edwards Aquifer in Texas, the Tar Pamlico Sound in North Carolina. Tell us what some other cities have done that we should do here in California.
Picking up with the Edwards, one of the things that has been a big controversy there is overpumping of the Edwards Aquifer, and the result being some problems with some salamander that lives in one of the springs. And so one of the things that they've done in the Edwards and here in California, the Tehachapi Basin, they've assigned rights to pump water from the ground. And it depends on how much recharge there is into the groundwater basin. It depends on, you know, how close the wells are spaced. But once you get over those problems, which really are pretty trivial, then you can assign rights and people either pump or sell water, but they can't just deplete the aquifer. So there again, you have to create rights and then let markets work. And that's happened in the Tehachapi, as I said. It's happened in the Edwards. And Montana, where I live most of the time, we have some restrictions and have looked at solving these property rights problems. I did some consulting for the city of Singapore a few years ago, a country to municipality, and they were buying water from Malaysia, and their contracts were coming due. They were figuring out all kinds of ways to deal with the potential shortages that would be caused if Malaysia said, we won't deliver you water. And so they raised prices, they recycle, but they do so with an eye towards how do you do it most efficiently. The Tarpamlico Sound is a case where an environmental group, the Nature Conservancy in this case, I have to be careful, it might have been the Environmental Defense Fund, I'm not sure. So,
well, hold you to
whichever
it.
They were good guys in this case. The Tarpamlico was out of compliance with EPA water quality standards. It was all the local municipalities and industries had cleaned up their acts, still was out of compliance because mostly hog farms. And they're scattered everywhere. And so this environmental group came in and created a collective of these industries that were going to be shut down almost, and said, look, why don't we put some money up and we'll go pay farmers to control their pig poop. And that market worked very well, and it worked. Yes, there was an EPA compliance level, that was the cap, if you will, but beyond that, the market worked well. Cities in the east, southeast particularly, used to think, well, we've got as much water as we'll ever need. But they had a drought a few years ago, and they started thinking about water markets. How could they trade? And I think in this sense, the system we have in the west, which is the prior appropriation water system that P.J. Hill talked about yesterday, that system does define rights, and it can be tradable. And I think that kind of system is going to move back to the east, where they're going to face more water scarcity as well.
Well, you nailed it with your Singapore example. Politicians having an eye toward efficiency and markets, as opposed to electing politicians who have an eye towards managing scarcity and, you know, mandates and people using less and control and manipulate. You know what I mean? So that's certainly where we are now. Sir, we have 30 seconds. Do you have a final thought for us Californians?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you were taking a call.
No. Your final thought, Terry.
Well, my final thought is that liberty, markets, and the environment go hand in hand. Free market environmentalism is not about how markets can do rape and pillage to the environment. It's about holding people accountable. It's about encouraging gains from trade. And through those processes, we end up with both a healthier and wealthier environment, as well as a healthier and wealthier society.
Just look around at America. The reason we are as prosperous, what I'm looking for. Prosperous as we are is because of property rights. So why not also apply them to water? Terry, pleasure talking to you, sir. Enjoy your time here up at Stanford.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, I appreciate it. Terry Anderson right there from PERC, PERC.org. Really great stuff. Total opposite of how our friends in Sacramento are approaching this and every other problem. PERC.org. Mike Slater Show. Spread the word. Yesterday, we had the distinct pleasure of spending some time with Meb Keflezighi. Meb's story is so inspirational, and I just want to make sure everyone knows it. He's from Eritrea. We'll get to that story in a second here. He grew up in San Diego, though. Won the silver medal at the 2004 Olympics and won last year's Boston Marathon. So let's get the full story from the man himself. How are you today, Meb?
I'm good, thanks again.
Good. I'm glad you're here. Take us back last year. Well, actually, take us back when you heard about the bombing. I didn't know you dedicated the year to the next Boston, to train for the next Boston Marathon. So how'd you hear about the bombing?
Well, I was at the race in 2013 before the bomb occurred. I was at the grandstand watching the races, watched people come at different times for four and a half hours, and I had to leave because I had an appointment for an interview. Other than that, I had a great experience watching the my fellow marathoners get across that finish line from the elite to the wheelchair and to the average runners. And, you know, I just said how wonderful it was. It seemed like it was a graduation kind of ceremony coming across that finish line, Boston Street. And I left 5 to 7 minutes after I left. I heard somebody told me I just walked 300 meters, you know, get crowded and all that stuff. And somebody told me that there was bombing on Boston Street. I'm like, how can it be? I left my brother there. I just saw tons of people there. And in fact, at one point, the street was so close. Crowded the chutes. They have 2 chutes with Boston, and they will close one of them. I tell them, hey, it's getting congested. People are trying to run their heart out, and you need to open it. I told that volunteer, and they opened it, and next thing you know, is everything changed for the worse.
Unbelievable. So you were just there a few minutes. You left a few minutes before the bomb went off.
Right. Amazing. Yeah, yeah.
What does that attack mean? Of course, we know what it... We get the big picture of it, right? A terrorist attack, all the rest. But to attack something that means so much to you and means so much to that city and means so much to marathon runners, the Boston Marathon, how did that strike you as a runner?
It was an inhuman act. I mean, the Marathon Monday on Patriots Day, you know, running is the glorious that you get the freedom to run freely around the streets where family and friends come and join you the finish line. It was a great event, epic event, and unfortunately it got disrupted because unkind people decided to disrupt it and take our freedom away, and it was horrifying. And knowing my background, coming back from Eritrea, where I was born, and I left because of war and unsafety, and here you are in the U.S., that's definitely been taken away from us.
I want to get your story of coming over to America in a little bit, if you don't mind, but what did you decide to do after that? You said you dedicated the next year to the next year's marathon.
Yeah, I mean, somebody asked me, Ford, ESPN writer, she asked me, are you going to come back? I said, I have to come back. I have to be here. In presence to support, but I hope I'm healthy enough to win for the people is what I told her right within hours of what happened at the Fairmont Copley Center. And basically you hear about it, you know, we had a week later, I believe we had something run in San Diego, and hundreds of people showed up, if not thousands. And you see the Boston Strong mantra. I wanted to give it all that I can to be ready for that day, and it's not for lack of trying to win the Boston Marathon, but I know it was greater than myself. It was for the 4 people that we lost, Martin, Sean, and Crystal, and Zing, that I wrote on my bib number to get inspired to run for a reason. And I was so delighted to be able to pull off the victory in front of the 36,000 people that started the race.
I'm going to ask you this question and answer it as Meb pre-2013. So, Meb, why do you run? Why do you want to win? What drives you?
Mike, I'm a competitor by nature, but what I keep running is my God-given talent that I ran in 520 at Roosevelt Junior High in 7th grade. I want to make sure that potential is fulfilled, and it has fulfilled in 2014 Boston Marathon. But, you know, every time you step up to the plate, you want to give it your best, and for me, winning doesn't mean getting first place, but giving it the best out of yourself. And for me, I went with Boston with 3 goals: to win, to podium, and to run my personal best. If I could run my personal best and other guys beat me, let it be. I was ready. But, you know, Coach Larson and I have been working for a long time together, and I remember before I went to the starting line, we talked about confidence. That he said I could. He said he could run 207, 208 on that course. And I told him, don't worry, I'm going to be also holding my horses until the last 3 miles. But what I did is assess the people and the competitors of mine and made a move. And on a marathon, you can't do that, you know, point to point. But after 5 miles, I said, I had the mantra, Boston Strong. I wanted to give a map strong and be ready to live with the consequences, whether I win, finish third, or run a personal best. And I gave it all that I had. It got really close at the end, but, you know, like I said, the crowd was phenomenal, and I had a greater reason to run for those four people and for the people that got affected by the bombing. And I was able to be able to hold it together and finish strong and run my fastest marathon ever. And it was my 20th marathon, and then to be able to do it on a tough Boston course, it just tells you there's higher power and also what was the motivation. But prior to 2013, I was ready to retire in my New York City marathon in 2013. I already had a deal done. And
really?
Because of the bombing and because of the cancellation of Hurricane Sandy in New York, I decided to give it another shot of keep going, and that's what happened.
Come on, so you weren't even planning on running that last marathon, and then you ran your personal best and won the darn thing. And I mean, I don't know. Would you say that was top three greatest moments of your career?
Oh, most definitely the top career of my entire career. And Mike, you also have to understand, as humans, we try to put limitation on ourselves, but we surround ourselves with good people, and the support is endless. And keep moving, doing the right reason, the right thing for the right reason, and that's what I did. And obviously, you know, as Coach said, I probably had my game face on year round, trying to visualize. I crossed myself. I didn't just cross myself on Boylston Street, but I crossed myself many times in training to visualize how what I want to do to change Boylston Street to something positive from the catastrophic and disastrous moment that we saw. And I wanted to chant USA, USA, so I feel very proud to be able to do that.
Coach, could you tell as the race was going on that something special was happening?
Absolutely. The key for me was, we had talked about it the night before, that he'd run well two times there, but stuff had happened that prevented him from being at his best when he got to 21 miles at the top of the hills. And I pointed out to him that how efficient he is running downhill, where he has a downhill after 21 miles. And if he got to that point this year, that, you know, he'd be the dangerous guy, and almost anything could happen. And when he got to 21 and had a pretty good lead, I just knew something great was going to happen. And it really did.
The last marathon I ran at mile 21, I had about another hour and a half to go. So you had to hurry up and get to the finish line because he was about done in a couple minutes. We actually have the last couple seconds here. Guys, I know you're busy. Meb, you probably got to get back to running. I don't know if we're cutting into your training time. I don't know how many hours a day you run, but probably most. Can you guys stick around for just a few more minutes?
Yes.
Be wonderful. We're talking with Meb and Bob Larson. And Meb, when do you leave for the next marathon here?
I leave Thursday. I'm in Mammoth Lakes. I got one more week here. I leave on Thursday to San Diego and then fly from San Diego to Red Eye.
Are you going to defend your title?
It's not an easy task, but I'm ready. I'm healthy and giving my best shot. And obviously, I run to win, getting the best out of myself. And, you know, in our sport, you can't play defense. But if the other guys are half trained harder than me, and then they, you know, hopefully I will outsmart them and then see what happens.
I will get a little more of Meb's immigrant story coming up next. Mike Slater Show, spread the word.
Are they going to get him?
Are they going to get him?
8 seconds looks like 10 seconds.
Boy, and he is striding with the confidence of a champion right now. This is a great scene.
This could be one of the great wins in the history of the Boston Marathon. We got to broadcast till 4 p.m. We're not going to make it.
They're going to have to bring in some oxygen for us here on the photo bridge.
Salazar, 1:82. Meyer, 1:83. Koflesny's going to win it in 2014.
The superstition in me will not allow myself
there
to say
is,
that.
There he is, Meb. You're 100 yards from the finish line right here. What are you thinking, man?
Chubb looked so close. Chubb looked like he's
I always dream of winning the Boston Marathon, and I did twice. I finished third and fifth, and to be able to do it after the bombing in 2014, I almost retired at least a couple times in 2008, not going to Beijing, and making New York my last one, 2013. But to keep that dream alive, 2 weeks shy of my 39th birthday, what a relief to close my career. You know, as an athlete, you don't usually get all what you want. You know, to be able to silver medalist, win New York, and now to win the Boston Marathon, my dream came true. And what a better way to do it, and in a positive way, on Boylston Street to say USA, USA, everybody in the street taking pictures, so loud. It was an amazing experience.
Here it is. Here's the finish.
Who cares what time it is?
Oh, it's wonderful.
Look at Yordanos' wife. His wife, Yordanos, is down there.
Just jumped into his arms at the finish.
That's awesome, Meb. I'm fired up. I can't wait. So, Meb, so my sport growing up, swimming, right? So swimming, it's 2 minutes is my race. I'm so focused. I don't hear anything. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I'm so totally focused. Your race is 2 hours. Are you totally focused the whole time? And then my other question is, like, when do you let yourself really take in the crowd and take in the moment? Or are you too focused on running fast?
You know, you go through the different phases of the 2 hours, and sometimes you are so focused. Like in Boston, I don't remember going to the halfway point. I don't remember what my split was by any mean. I was so in the zone that I was trying to get my, you know, pushed through the envelope and pushing hard and trying to make the gap bigger. But you love the crowd. I mean, I love running track and cross country, but in the roads, you're so close to the people. People shouting your name or shouting your USA, USA. In fact, about 18 and a half, 19 miles, people were doing the waves and going USA, USA. I couldn't help it but to fist pump my arm and join them to USA, USA. But I'm like, focus.
Keep running. You know? Keep running. Don't give high fives. Keep running.
Right. But, you know, I enjoy it. I really do. And then the sport has done some amazing thing in my life. I feel, you know, that 720 that I ran in seventh grade, finally I knew I was meant to be a runner on this earth through God's mercy and give me the opportunity that I has and come to the United States with to be able to become a citizen and be able to live here and be a positive contributor to society.
Well, let's talk about that for a couple minutes here. How did you and your family come from Eritrea to here? How and why?
Oh, the reason we left Eritrea was because of the war for independence against Ethiopia, and my dad has to walk 225 miles to Sudan and not knowing what he's going to get his next meal or get his next night of sleep, because in 225 miles, it's a long way in the wilderness of hyenas, lions, scorpions, snakes, and soldiers. You know, you have to mend in, but he made it. And fortunately, I talk all about that on my book, Run to Overcome, the journey. And then he made it to Sudan, got two different jobs, and then my sister's Ruth's mom, half-sister Ruth, her mom was living in Italy. She helped him escape from Sudan to Italy, and then from Italy, we both helped each other, and Dr. Brindici, who was their boss, gave him $6,000, which is 10,000 lira at the time, and to help us save from Eritrea. And on October 21st, 1987, we landed in beautiful San Diego.
Wait, what? First of all, how did you, why San Diego?
The reason we ended up in San Diego is because my sister Ruth, her mom helped us escape to Italy, was living in San Diego, and through the help of Ruth, who sponsored us, and the Red Cross help assistance, we came to San Diego.
Amazing. How old were you when you got here?
I came here when I was 12 years old and didn't speak a word of English, very timid. And, I was supposed to be starting in seventh grade, but instead they put me 1 year so I could learn English. I went to Jefferson Elementary and North Park. And then obviously, you know, seventh grade is where I discovered my running. But my parents told us, you have this opportunity. We don't want you to waste it. We didn't have it. Your uncles don't have it. Your cousins don't have it. So work hard. And this is a land of opportunity. Make sure you maximize your hard work. And that's what we did all. I might get the notoriety of my athletic accomplishment, but all my brothers and sisters have gone and accomplished great things, from engineering to a doctor to law, MBA and Stanford and Berkeley graduates. So we work hard.
Amazing. Mab, let me tell you, yesterday we had a World War II veteran on, and he told the story of when he was 10 years old and his grandfather, who lived in Ukraine and then made it to Amsterdam and then made it to America in the early 1900s. And the grandpa was sitting on the front porch with his with a bud, 10-year-old, and said, "Those streets, these streets right here, they're paved with gold." And Bud, 10-year-old Bud, laughed at him and said, "Oh, you didn't really believe that when you were coming over here, did you?" And he got mad. The grandpa got mad and said, "Son, come here." And they brought him to the street and he said, "Look at these streets. Look at these streets. These streets, they're paved with gold. And don't you ever forget it, because if you'd be if we didn't come here to America, then you'd be plowing a field. But instead, your parents are doing these great things, just like you described your family." So do you agree with that statement, that these streets that you run on are paved with gold?
Almost definitely. I mean, you think about the journey of my dad in the wilderness. Just imagine you going, wild animals, scorpions, snakes, and hyenas, lions, and whatnot. And then, you know, he has to do 30 miles a day just to make it through the journey. And at one point, he was gun-pointed. He could, if that person triggered that gun, none of us, this would have come true. So it was a divine intervention that
wow.
The shot didn't happen, and he made it to Sudan. But now when I run 26.2 miles, it's gold, because I mean, I got support screaming, and I got support every 5K to give me drinks, and there's medical tents that are there if I need help or whatever, that hopefully I don't have to use it. But you know, it's just amazing to be in the U.S. and be able to, I never knew running was a sport. I thought people were crazy that they were running, you know, not chasing a soccer ball, anything like that.
Yeah.
But you know, this is to have to pinch myself that, you know, I live the American dream. And as a veteran that you were talking about, you know, one way or another, we have all grandparents or grandparents have immigrated from somewhere to come to the land of opportunity, United States, to get a better life for their family. And, you know, my daughters have that, you know, help they understand, our three daughters, that how lucky they are that their grandparents sacrificed so we can have a better life, and I have a better life so that I could have a better life. So, you know, it's a journey.
That was Mav. We chatted with him yesterday. How good is that? How good is that story? Just think, I think of Bud's family, grandparents going from Ukraine, their journey from Ukraine to Amsterdam, and Meb's family going from Eritrea to Sudan. It's the same thing. Different color skin, different terrain they're navigating, but the same story, because they both had the same goal in mind. And it's where you and I are right now. Hannity up next.